The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Debbie and I have decided to pledge $100,000 to the family fund of the January 6th defendants. We'll tell you why. I'm also going to have Cynthia Hughes, a woman who is close to these families, talk about the ordeals that they go through. Also, will Andrew Cuomo finally go down? Is he going to be, politically speaking, sleeping with the fishes? This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Debbie and I have made a decision to contribute $100,000 to the family fund of the January 6th defendants. Kind of a big decision for us. We do some philanthropy, but we do it normally privately. But we made a decision to do this because these are families in desperate need. I've been covering January 6th, talking about it more in the larger political sense, the targeting, the ruthlessness of the government's prosecutions, but on a human scale, there is a there's a human tragedy. Of course, the family members are innocent. They are victims also of all of this, and they are victims of something that I have not seen happen in this country, at least not in my lifetime. So I wanted Debbie to join me so we could talk a little bit about this and what we hope to accomplish by doing this. Obviously, I don't make any of these decisions without you, honey. So talk to me for a moment about why you thought this was a good idea.
Well, first of all, I didn't know any of the details. And we have found out some details, not just the treatment of the prisoners that are you know, in prison right now. Not having any rights, basically mocking them. There have been some reports of some beatings. There have been reports of them just, you know, letting them defecate, urinate, all of those horrible things that happen to prisoners that are in third world countries. I always come back to the Venezuela issue, right? The Venezuela parallels. One of the parallels, of course, that I've talked about for a very long time is targeting political opponents, not just targeting them as in mocking them, making fun of them, making them irrelevant in society, but incarcerating them and not letting them have due process, making them pretending that they're going to at some point see a lawyer and go to court and everything will be like, okay, you pay a fine. You'll be, you know, it's all good. That doesn't happen in Venezuela. These people rot in jail and in many instances die in jail. I'm not insinuating that is what is going to happen here, but I'm appalled by what has happened. And more importantly, I am just horrified as to what's happened to the families left behind. That, to me, is heartbreaking. Some of these people had absolutely there was no fault of their own that these patriots go out there. You know, they think that what they're doing is the right thing to do. We all know why they did it. We can't talk about it, which is even more poignant, more eerie, the fact that we ourselves can't even talk about why they went to the Capitol in the first place. But I think of it as they went out there to do something that we all thought was the case, right? But yet these people are in jail right now.
Yeah, it's important to make the point. Many of these guys are working class guys. This is guy's a plumber. He's got a wife. He's got two kids. And they saw themselves as fighting for Trump, right? And fighting for a cause they believed was right. Not just Trump, the individual, but fighting for a fair count.
I don't want people to think that this was just about Trump, because it wasn't. It really wasn't about Trump. It was really about the process and the fact that we thought we were robbed of this process.
I mean, for someone like me who, you know, went through this confrontation, saw the full force of the federal government, in some ways, I sympathize with them on that basis. But in other ways, my case is totally different. As you know, I mean, we met right around that time. But I mean, I had Ben Braffman, celebrity lawyer, one of the best lawyers in the country. I was, you know, I'd get out of my hearing. I'd go on the Megyn Kelly show that night.
Right.
So, and I could also see as a writer and as a sort of a public controversialist, as a public figure, that in some ways my career would even be enlarged.
Yeah.
I'd even be more recognized. But that is not the typical case.
Right.
These are people who will have enormous difficulty putting your life back together.
Well, if you had been a school teacher or a chef or somebody that depended on going to work every day, this wouldn't have worked for you.
Exactly.
It would have ruined your career.
I mean, what I find horrific here is that these are people who have been abandoned by their own side for the most part. I mean, there are a handful of people, Marjorie Taylor Greene, our friend Louis Gohmert, who have tried to speak up for them. By the way, when those guys went to the deplorables jail and they were blocked from going in, you know what the guards do? They retaliate against the defendants. They retaliate against the prisoners by putting them into lockdown, putting them into solitary. It's like, we'll teach you a lesson.
This is very Venezuela-like. This is how they treat the prisoners in Venezuela. Exactly like that. In fact, when people rally for them, the more they rally for them, the more retaliation they have in jail.
Wow. So, well, when I first mentioned this to you, and I mentioned that Julie Kelly was writing an article about this for American Greatness, this article appeared yesterday, you were a little uncomfortable. You're like, well, why are we doing this in public? So I kind of want to talk about why we're mentioning this, why we're even announcing it. And the reason is very simple. We want this to be something, we want to help directly. There are human needs at the most basic level. In the next segment, I'm going to bring on a woman, Cynthia Hughes, who has been coordinating on behalf of the families, and she's the one sort of bringing this direct aid to families. So we want to help directly. That's our first motive, our most direct motive. I mean, we're fortunate. I cannot think of a better use of our dollars at this point, quite honestly. But the second reason is I want to motivate other people, which is to say you, to help. And after I talk to Cynthia, I'm going to tell you how you can help. But we want you to join us in supporting these poor guys, supporting their families. By the way, you're not going to be giving money. They do have legal needs. Some of them have horrific lawyers. As you know, these lousy public defendants, half of them are leftists.
Yeah, exactly.
And some of them
exactly.
are propagandizing these people. Oh, listen, if you make a kind of Soviet-style confession, you'll be okay. So all of this stuff is going on. But legal fees is a complicated issue. I do want to help raise money for that. But most importantly, and what we're focusing on, where our money is going, where your money would be going, is the family fund. And this is basically to help people, pay their insurance,
pay their mortgage,
buy books for their kid to go to school. I mean, pay medical bills, just the most basic things.
Christmas is coming up. Those little babies, you know, Santa.
You cannot leave people on the field like this. It's just unconscionable. We can't do it. I don't believe you should do it either. So please join us do what you can within your capacity, within your means, but do stretch your means a little bit, because these are people who try to do what's right. They're paying a terrible penalty for it. They are political prisoners in that they are subject to a prosecution of a kind directed by the Attorney General personally, that we have not seen in this country. So we're turning a dark corner. We want to do our part to help, and we urge you to join us. Mike Lindell is having an important cyber symposium that he wants you to know about. Here's Mike talking about it. Listen.
I'm having a cyber symposium on August 10th, 11th, and 12th. This historical event will be live streamed 72 hours straight on my new platform, frankspeech.com.
Now, Mike is also going to offer all kinds of MyPillow specials during the symposium, and those will be featured on frankspeech.com. And but if you go there and you order, make sure to use the promo code Dinesh. That's how you'll get the discount. Now, I want to talk about specials that Mike is running now. His Giza Dream bed sheets. They're amazing. The first night you sleep on these sheets, wow, you're not going to want to sleep on anything else. These Giza Dream sheets from MyPillow, they come in a variety of sizes and colors. And Mike is making a special offer now for my listeners. Sale of the year. For a limited time, 50% off. It's as low as $49.99 on these sheets. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. The number to call, if you want to order that way, 800-876-0227. Again, 800-876-0227. Or go to MyPillow.com. Either way, make sure you use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. I'm joined now by Cynthia Hughes. Cynthia is the coordinator of a group of January 6th families where they're able to share information, talk about their lives, and talk about their needs. And she has a direct connection to one of the January 6th defendants. Cynthia, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me. Let me start by asking you to say a word about yourself, who you are, and what your connection is to January 6th.
Well, hello, Dinesh, and thank you for having me. So my direct connection is I have like an adopted nephew who is currently detained in the DC jail. He's been there since January. Well, he's been incarcerated since January. He's been in DC since February 3rd. He has no violent charges, no assault charges, no criminal history worth noting, and they refuse to release him.
Now, what is his name, and what did he actually do inside the Capitol?
His name is Timothy Hale, and I have to be careful talking about his case. He just has some pictures. He in his suit and tie, you know, being patriotic, celebrating America, and standing up for what he believes in. And now they're holding it against him. 23 hours a day in a cell, solitary confinement for these men, you know, guilty, and now, you know, have to prove their innocence, you know, fighting basically a monster of a government.
Now, Cynthia, here's a group of people, and I'm also talking about their families, because everyone who's incarcerated is attached to a family. Somehow you have become the de facto kind of coordinator of these families. How did you go from, you know, hey, I've got this adopted nephew, he's got charges against him. How did you become more connected to this wider community of January 6th defendants?
Well, it wasn't enough that these men have been in solitary confinement for many months, 23 hours a day in a cell. In May, there was a long lockdown. I think it was about 8 days. So they went from 23 to 24 hours with no contact with their families. It was very frustrating. So I just kind of felt that somebody needed to act. You know, enough was enough. So I decided to, you know, learn who the families were and connect with them and start a family support group, which has now evolved into something bigger, helping these families because they really need it.
Now, how many families are in this support group? Talk a little bit about how the families communicate with each other. And then I want to start talking about some of the individual families. How many families do you have in the group? Are these the people that are focused on in the DC jail? Because there are some defendants who are in other jails, aren't there?
Yes, there is. And we started out with just, you know, the DC detainees. But now it's, you know, branched out. We have people that are in Virginia. We have somebody incarcerated in Georgia. We have a lot of home confinement, you know, detainees, if you will. So it has branched out. So I would say, you know, we have over 50 families now involved with the support group. We get together every week. We just meet and greet to see how everybody's doing, check in, just support each other. We have counseling involved. We have pastors involved, a lot of support.
Well, it's very commendable that you're doing this, Cynthia, because, you know, I feel terrible because the GOP, the Republican Party, has done so little to help these guys. They've been sort of left on the field, you might almost say, in a war zone, because we know that the Biden administration is prosecuting them almost as if they're war criminals. You know, they're going after them. They've used the language of almost foreign terrorists. They've used the language of terrorism, of ISIS, of Al-Qaeda. They've made comparisons to the Oklahoma City bombing, to 9/11. Let's talk for a moment just about families, one by one, and start by describing, let's take a single family that you'd like to start by talking about and describe what they go through when this happens to them.
So I don't want to mention any names, of course, for their protection. But I can talk to you, I could give you four examples of what a true travesty looks like. So we have one wife who has three children under the age of three. Her husband is incarcerated in D.C. She does not have any family close by to where she lives at the moment. But her husband's family, which is large and very supportive and very wonderful, lives in another state. They had a business. The business is shuttered, and she's struggling to support herself. How is she going to support herself with twin babies that just turned 1 year old? So we have to relocate her. We have to get her where her in-laws are. She needs support. She needs financial support. That's just one case. We have another case of another woman. She has four children, all under the age of 17. Excuse me. One is like 1 year old. He just turned one. She works full time now. Her husband's incarcerated, in Virginia. She travels 30 minutes every day to drop her, you know, her youngest children off for daycare. She's so financially strapped that she literally donates her plasma to get extra money in addition to her income. That's what we're dealing with, okay? We have another family, three children under the age of 17, had to move out of her home, move in with her mother. She had to give away her two family pets because she couldn't afford to care for her two dogs anymore. She's struggling terribly. She went from two incomes to one income. She has a broken heating system in her home right now. What's going to happen when the colder weather comes and she needs to fix HVAC? We need to help her.
Cynthia, let's take a short pause. When we come back, I want to talk more about these families, more about their ordinary basic needs, more about the needs of the children. And I also want to talk specifically about how people can join us, join me and Debbie, and support these families if they feel moved to do so. We'll be right back. I've been on Hillary Clinton's trail for some time. In my film, Hillary's America, I detailed the dangers she posed to our country. Fortunately, the American people got the message in 2016, but there's still more that must be done to reveal the ugly truth about the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and their corrupt ways, especially since the Biden family seems to view the Clintons' example as a how-to guide. You won't find the truth about Hillary in today's fake news media. You have to turn to a powerful source like Capital Research Center. Now, my friends at Capital Research Center expose the left like no one else can. Now they've released an eye-opening new report that lays bare the corruption of the Clinton crime family. It's called By Hook or By Crook. Want to read it? Go to capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. You got the chance to order a free copy of By Hook or By Crook and learn the facts the mainstream media won't touch. Once again, that's Capital Research, CapitalResearch. That's capitalresearch.org/Dinesh. Check it out. I'm back with Cynthia Hughes. Cynthia Hughes is someone who has been organizing a kind of support group and a family fund for January 6 families. Cynthia, you were talking about, you were going through some of these examples of families, and you were about to talk about one, so go ahead.
So we have another family. This young lady is on home confinement. She has a young son. When she returned home from the Capitol, she discovered she was pregnant. She's pregnant right now. She's facing 16 years in prison if she's convicted. 16 years. She doesn't have family support. And I wonder what will happen to her baby if she is convicted and sent to jail. What will happen? Who's going to care for those children and infants? It's a true travesty, and we need to do something more about this. There needs to be more exposure about this, more talk about this. This is where I feel the collateral damage is. You know, it's almost like a humanitarian crisis when you think about it. And I feel very strongly that we have a government that is solely focused on revenge of the previous administration, Donald Trump specifically, that they can't see this. They're blinded. And this is the real crisis. Yes, the men being in jail is a crisis. We don't want that. They should be home. Nobody should be held in pretrial detention for 7 months. Nobody. Especially when a lot of these men do not have criminal history. So, but the travesty is what are we doing for these families? I mean, why isn't this government considering that? That is a real concern.
I mean, what you're finding, aren't you, Cynthia, is a kind of willingness, and in fact, not only willingness, but almost an eagerness to destroy these people's lives. I mean, I think that was the point of the whole staged hearing with the Capitol Hill police. It was an attempt to make the Capitol Hill police into the real victims. And they were basically, this guy pushed me, that guy shoved me, this guy poked me, you know, and I'm, you know, virtually had tears. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, you guys, you know, you're trained policemen. You go into this profession, you're guarding a door, some guy pushed you, okay. And we've even heard about suicides on the part of these Capitol Hill police guys. And then I'm thinking to myself, look at all these people in prison and look at their families and look at what they're going through. I don't know what this young woman did to be facing 16 years, but quite honestly, show me someone on the left who did that, that got 1 year in prison. 1 year. Not 16 years, but 1 year. And the sheer inequity of it is what I think infuriates us. And then as we've got to know you, Debbie, and me, we've come to see that you've just got a human tragedy here, and you've got a human tragedy in which the people who should be helping are saying nothing about it. Even the GOP leadership has been largely silent, and if it wasn't for a handful of people, notably Julie Kelly and her work in American Greatness, we wouldn't even know some of the details about what's happening in these individual cases. What would be your message to the Republican leadership vis-a-vis these people who came to fight for a cause and are now facing essentially the ruin of their lives?
I would say to them that they need to kind of stop thinking about themselves, thinking about the vote that they need, you know, in either 22 or 24, and think about, I want them to look at their own children, those who have young children, look at, or your grandchildren, look at your children. And think about, that could be you. I mean, think about it, right? We live in a country where there's no more, I mean, I apologize for not having the right words, but when you have people that are in a jail, in pretrial detention, in a few more months, it's going to be 1 year. This government is not even prepared to try these cases. Why is nobody speaking out about this? We do have Marjorie Taylor Greene. We do have Matt Gaetz. We do have that team, and thank God for them. It's not enough. Where's Jim Jordan, for example? You know, where's Mitch McConnell? Where's Mitch McConnell? Why is he not concerned about these people that voted for him? It's really concerning. And I think people need to remember that next year and in 24.
The good thing, Cynthia, is we're trying to do something. We're doing what we can. You're doing what you can. I want to tell people, if they want to support these families, we're talking about money that's going to go to buying toys for kids, paying essential medical bills, helping people keep afloat and not be evicted from their homes. Now, you have a website. And you and a committee are going to make sure, because you have, we've talked and you have detailed knowledge of who these families are and what their needs are. Let's talk about the website where people can go to get more information and to donate. And second of all, describe what's going to happen. If someone gives you money, how are you going to make sure that money gets promptly and effectively to people who need it?
So we have a platform. It's called PatriotFreedomProject.com. There's many ways you can contribute and donate. You can donate through the platform. You can donate through GiveSendGo, or you can go and mail a check or a money order. All the information is on the website. There is an advisory board. We've already paid the rent for some of these families. We've already sent money to some of these families who need help with school supplies, school shoes, the coming school year. We're going to make sure we help these families, you know, through Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas. My thing is, you know, I go back to the first family I spoke to you about. There's a young boy who was home the day his daddy was arrested. He saw many men come into his home in the police, law enforcement, you know, type. And that's what's in his mind. Seeing his daddy being taken out of the home by police. We have to do something about that. So we need to maybe get counseling involved. We're going to provide as much support and as many services as possible to these families.
And as far as I know, you're the only one doing it. So let me close by telling people that the website to go to is called PatriotFreedomProject.com. I hope this has been as, you know, moving to you and eye-opening to you as it has been for me. Please join Debbie and me in opening your heart and contributing what you can to help some people who have been left on the field who really need it and who will be, for your help, eternally grateful. Thank you very much. In May 2011, the White House leaked that SEAL Team 6 had killed bin Laden, and immediately Al-Qaeda placed bounties on the heads of all Navy SEALs. Just 3 months later, on August 6, 2011, a helicopter carrying many SEALs from that same elite unit was shot down in Tangi Valley, Afghanistan, with no survivors. 30 Americans died that day in the single greatest incident loss of life in the history of the Navy SEALs' U.S. Special Operations. But huge questions remain. Where was the black box, and why was it missing? Did our restrictive rules of engagement contribute to this tragic outcome? What really happened to SEAL Team 6? Learn what we now know about the tragic mission. Watch the provocative new film, Fallen Angel. Now, the full title is Fallen Angel, call sign Extortion 17. The film is showing only on SalemNow.com. Once again, the name of the movie, Fallen Angel, call sign is Extortion 17, exclusively available on SalemNow.com. There are job shortages all around the United States, employers who can't find workers. And Biden's solution? Pay them more. So we're going to try to look at Biden's remedy and see why that is so preposterous, why that in fact contravenes the law of economics. So here I have in front of me, I'm going to kind of show it to you. This was put on Fox News by Larry Kudlow. It's a chart of the package of government benefits that are available to people. This is kind of why people who are getting this whole slew of benefits don't want to go back to work. So let's look at these benefits. This is from, by the way, the source is the Foundation of Government Accountability. Regular state unemployment insurance, $1,000 per month. Weekly unemployment bonus of $300. That's $1,300 per month. Food stamps, $365 per month. Child tax credit, $600 per month. Earned income tax credit, $426 per month. So the total package, $3,694 per month. That's almost $3,700 per month. Debbie's like, let's quit the podcast. Let's collect. I didn't know about this. Wow. This is news to me. But this is exactly the point. Now, Biden doesn't think this is the problem. He doesn't think that economic incentives really apply here. And when asked about it, this is what he had to say. Listen.
Remember, you're asking me, and I'm not being critical of y'all. I really mean this. It was legitimate questions you're asking me. Asking me, well, you know, guess what? Employers can't find workers. I said, yeah, pay them more.
Well, pay them more. What I love about that, if you really think about the tone, what is Biden saying? He's going, it's really obvious. There's an easy solution. This shouldn't be hard, guys. All you have to do is pay them more. So now, rather than just ridicule this, I want to go to Economics 101. Biden hasn't, but I will. And talk about why. Why is it that employers can't just raise prices? You may say, well, that's because it's going to cost consumers more. But let's say that we don't care about that. Let's say that the consumers who don't want to pay won't pay. They'll buy something else. Why can't an employer simply jack up the price? Well, the answer has to do with a distinction in economics, something you kind of learn in first year economics, between what is called elastic and inelastic goods. This sounds like technical terms, and they are, but they have a very clear meaning. So an elastic good is a good where if you raise the price, people will buy something else. An inelastic good is something that people have to buy. So even if you raise the price, they're going to have to buy it. Let's just say, for example, an inelastic good would be toilet paper. If all the toilet paper companies raise their price, well, you and I still need toilet paper. We're not going to kind of, you know, go Slumdog Millionaire and stop using toilet paper. We're going to need toilet paper. Or printer's ink. Debbie and I use printer's ink every day. If the price of ink went up, we still have to do our work, do the podcast, write my books. We'd still buy the ink, even if it costs more. But this is not true of, let's say, for example, sushi. Let's say that we like sushi. We eat sushi probably once a week. Let's say the price of sushi went up dramatically. We might say, well, you know, we like it, but not that much. So we'll eat something else. We'll go Italian. So the bottom line of it is that there are products, and I think this applies to most products. They are elastic, which is to say that the employer, yeah, you can say, well, you know, I'm selling sushi, so I'm just going to raise the price. No, people are going to stop eating sushi. They're going to move to something else. And therefore, the company can't do it. What Biden is asking is, in fact, something that is unreasonable. Now, what we're talking about here is the fact that the laws of economics are based upon the idea that human beings are rational. We're not entirely rational. We sometimes have non-rational motives for things we do. But by and large, and particularly when it comes to our wallet, our pocketbook, our savings, we generally make rational decisions by saying, how much is this going to cost? There's something else cheaper. Can I get the same deal? Is gas cheaper if I drive 2 miles? Is it worth it for me to do that? People make these kinds of calculations all the time, and the discipline of economics is based upon them. So what we have here is an administration that not only is ignorant of the laws of economics, I don't think it doesn't really care about them. It's indifferent to whether or not it imposes hardship on businesses. And this gives you an idea of the ideological thrust, the anti-business thrust that now defines the modern left and the Democratic Party. On July 4, 1776, we declared our independence from taxation from a government an ocean away. Today, our government is the one imposing oppressive taxes while at the same time sending our wealth overseas and driving the value of the dollar into the ground through reckless spending. This is the time to declare your independence for your savings. Cut your ties to the U.S. dollar and invest in gold and silver with Birch Gold Group. Now, if you haven't reached out to Birch Gold to diversify part of your IRA or 401k into a precious metals IRA, do it today. Text Dinesh to 484848. Get a free information kit on protecting your savings with gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, and over 10,000 happy customers. Talk to them. Have them help you safeguard your investments. Text Dinesh to 484848. Claim your free information kit and speak with a precious metals expert on holding gold and silver in a tax-sheltered account. Again, text Dinesh to 484848. And protect your savings today. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo may finally be going down. Yep, finally. Politically speaking, I think he's going to end up with Luca Brasi at the bottom of the ocean, as they say in The Godfather, sleeping with the fishes. Now, here's a guy who has been conducting you could almost call it a one-man campaign against the Me Too movement. If you look at the latest report, this is a report by the state attorney general, Letitia James. She validates 11 cases of sexual harassment. But Even worse, she elaborates an elaborate network that is intended to discredit, smear, and undermine these accusations and the accusers themselves. I'll get to this in a minute. It's very interesting that Cuomo's support has finally kind of eroded. Biden, who has his own issues here. I had Tara Reid on the podcast. Here's another guy who needs an investigation for sure. But Biden's calling on him to resign. Pelosi, both as the senators in New York, both Democrats. And now it turns out that Carl Heastie, the Speaker of the Assembly, he's finally broken ranks. He was kind of Cuomo loyalist. And every single congressman in New York has dropped away from Cuomo. Hakeem Jeffries is pretty typical. He goes, the time is up. He should have resigned. By the way, Elise Stefanik, Republican in New York, says that the guy needs to be arrested. This is not simply a matter of him resigning. He needs to be criminally prosecuted for not only the harassment directly, but creating a hostile atmosphere in the whole office with a kind of team of enablers. Now, this brings us really to the most interesting part of this whole deal, which isn't just that Chris Cuomo, by the way, at CNN, is sending memos to Andrew Cuomo for how he can basically get out of this. Here you go. Chris is kind of the media guy, the media savvy guy. Let's call him the media savvy bro to tell me how I can beat this. And here's Chris Cuomo. He goes, this is his actual draft from an email. He goes, he's telling Andrew Cuomo to say this. Sometimes I'm playful and make jokes. You've seen me do it at briefings hundreds of times. My only desire is to add some levity and banter. Now, Chris Cuomo is not a journalist. This is a guy who's conspiring with his brother to cover up something really, really bad that deep down Chris Cuomo probably knows that Andrew Cuomo did. The other thing that's really interesting is that Andrew Cuomo has recruited, his top lieutenants were recruiting LGBTQ and Me Too leaders in the movement to protect him against his accusers. Now, you have to step back to see the significance of this. Let's go into a couple of the details. Two of his lieutenants recruited the president of the Human Rights Campaign. This is a guy named Alfonso David. Alfonso David had the file of Lindsay Boylan, one of the accusers. For some reason, he used to work for the governor's office. He took the file with him, so they had to get the file back. So they call up this guy and they say, hey, listen, we want the file back so we can leak it to the media. And the file, of course, had complaints against Lindsay Boylan. So this is a personnel file. It should be private. But they got it. This guy, David, turned it over. And where does it end up? It's sent out to the New York Times, the New York Daily News. So this is the weaponizing of the whole department and the use of this gay activist. There's also a prominent Me Too activist that was drawn into this circle. And she's like, yeah, I'll protect you. I'll work with you. Let's go after these accusers. Now, this is not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is when you pretend to be something you're not, but this goes beyond hypocrisy. This is something more like this. You have a guy who wants to commit a murder. And so he realizes the best way to commit a murder is to dress up as a cop. He's not a cop. He has no interest in being a cop. It is a pure costume that you put on to get away with something that is the exact opposite of what a cop represents. That's what's going on here. These people, by their actions, you can see they don't really believe in the Me Too movement, but they are embracing the category of Me Too for a really simple reason. It's a marvelous cover to do the exact opposite. So Democrats love Me Too because they realize it's a license for sexual harassment. I bet you that Governor Cuomo has learned from Bill Clinton, because Bill Clinton realized, if I'm for women's rights, if I talk about the rights of women, then, and if my wife is an enabler of what I do, she can then turn around and she has the credibility, and the feminists and the Me Too people will back her to go after my accusers. It's basically a get out of jail free card. And so what I'm suggesting is that the whole Me Too movement is a costume put on by Democrats to cover the fact that when it comes to sexual abuse and sexual predation, they are the guilty parties. When someone asks you, how are you? Do you ever stop to think about that? Remember just a few short years ago when you had so much more energy, when you were more vibrant, back when you felt so much healthier than you do now? Don't just blame aging for how poorly you feel. Getting the right nutrition back into your body could be what you're missing. Try Balance of Nature. Just knowing you're getting vital nutrients every day sourced from 31 fruits and veggies will make a huge difference in your life. 10 daily servings of fruits and veggies, and it's all in 6 small capsules. They're absolutely no trouble, always fresh, nothing artificial, ready to take. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers receive an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Once again, call 800-246-8751. 800-246-8751. Or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. Supposedly, the Biden administration is doing a investigation into the origins of COVID, seeking to validate, if it can, the idea that COVID-19 might have come from the Wuhan lab. Now, I don't have a great deal of faith in this investigation. I feel that it is a little bit bogus, an effort to cover up China's culpability in this. But nevertheless, the investigation is supposedly underway. The WHO is also trying to open an investigation, although the Chinese are blocking them. I want to talk not about the blockage on the Chinese side, but the blockage on the American side, and particularly the media. And I want to focus here on the New York Times, because the New York Times often sets the tone for the rest of the media. And very interestingly, from the very beginning, the New York Times was one of the earliest to dismiss the lab leak theory. Of course, they didn't even touch the bioweapons theory. They very early on tried to move the responsibility for the origins of COVID to a natural cause, to a wet market in Wuhan. And while they were doing this, the New York Times was taking money left and right from Chinese outlets and Chinese institutions, notably a Chinese state-owned propaganda outlet called China Daily. And if you follow the coverage of the New York Times in the early stages of COVID, and by the early stages, I mean all the way from March of last year to a few weeks ago, when the lab leak theory suddenly became respectable again, in this entire period of many months, the New York Times was kind of working with the China Daily almost as two sides of a scissors, kind of working in tandem. So going back even to the Trump administration, when Trump announced his travel ban to China, the New York Times was front and center attacking the travel ban. They call it isolationist, as if Trump had no rationale, and this just represented a kind of maniacal withdrawal from the world for, quote, no good reason. New York Times also constantly celebrated China's success in battling the virus, always using the Chinese government's propagandistic figures. At one point, and this is actually a little bit of a comic, the CCP had claimed that in August of 2020, they said that 4,634 Chinese people had died from the virus. This is as of August 2020. And 6 months later, they reported 4,636 deaths. In other words, the Chinese were claiming that over the 6 month period, in a country of a billion plus people, exactly 2 additional people died of COVID-19. And the New York Times, with a straight face, reports these figures as if, yeah, that's it. Those are the numbers. There we go. No reason to question them whatsoever. When Senator Tom Cotton said, hey, maybe we should look at this, where this virus came from, a very noncommittal, the kind of spirit of inquiry type of statement, the New York Times attacks him, ridicules him, calls it a, quote, fringe theory. Well, it was sort of a fringe theory because the New York Times had pushed it to the fringe. The New York Times had led a media battalion that ridiculed anybody. So they create the fringe and then they denounce you for being on the fringe. The New York Times also published articles by Peter Daszak, the zoologist, who, by the way, was not only doing so-called gain-of-function research, not only collaborating with Bat Lady in China, with the Wuhan lab itself, but collecting money from the U.S. taxpayer through the government, collecting government grants, and then funneling them to the Wuhan lab. So in other words, this collaboration also involved money changing hands, U.S. taxpayer money going to China. No. The New York Times, if it didn't know about this, is grossly negligent. I suspect that they did know. But in either event, they didn't disclose it to their readers. They didn't say, hey, listen, this guy is actively involved in this gain-of-function research. He has a vested interest in trying to throw the blame for the origins of the virus onto the wet market. So what happens here is that throughout the early stages of this, a whole year of the epidemic, what was happening is that the China Daily would put out propaganda, the New York Times would then repeat the propaganda, and then literally minutes later, the China Daily would retweet the New York Times as if to say, see, what we're saying is true, here's the New York Times reporting the same thing. So the New York Times gets it from China Daily, they put it out, China Daily then uses it to, quote, corroborate what the New York Times has been saying. So you begin to see here how a once respectable newspaper has utterly disgraced itself. Now, the New York Times does have a sordid history. I mean, they did all kinds of propagandistic coverage for Stalin. A reporter named Walter Duranty would minimize the Soviet famines. He would minimize the Stalinist show trials. He was essentially in the pocket of the Soviet communists. The New York Times does, but that was limited to Duranty. He was the New York Times man in Russia at the time. So it was a, but this did not represent the Times as a whole. What we've basically seen is that the Duranty disease, which is converting news into absolute propaganda, has now metastasized to the paper as a whole. The New York Times is quite honestly no longer the New York Times. It's hard even to call it anymore a newspaper. They have published all kinds of essentially advertorials, by which I mean they take advertising money and then write an editorial that's bought and paid for by China. Interestingly, they've now gone back and stealth edited some of those. They've gone back and cleaned them up to pretend like they never existed. This is, again, very Orwellian. You publish something, it's disgraceful. Instead of apologizing for it, what you do is you go back and change it retroactively. So all this disgraceful behavior by a news outlet that is the New York Times, that is at the forefront of American journalism, and this shows you that American journalism itself is in a state of extreme crisis. There's no doubt in my mind that Americans' trust in the media is at an all-time low. I mean, when you turn on so-called respected news channels, all you get is state propaganda, shameless virtue signaling, and a blatant disregard of the truth. It's an insult to the intelligence of the American people, which is why my good friends at the Daily Wire are providing an alternative. From the Daily Wire newsroom comes Morning Wire, a morning news podcast that gives you the facts you need to know first. Brought to you by Daily Wire Editor-in-Chief John Bickley and co-host Georgia Howe, Morning Wire will wake you up with the latest developments in politics, sports, culture, and education, all with a heavy emphasis on the truth. Episodes drop every weekday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, so go subscribe now to hear the trailer. And if you like what you hear, leave a 5-star review if you want to help Daily Wire provide a source Americans can wake up and trust. Each episode will be short with only enough room to fit the facts, so you can be sure your breakfast isn't being served with a side of someone else's agenda. Subscribe to Morning Wire as soon as you can. One of the key differences at the root level between a conservative and a liberal, or conservative and a progressive, is that conservatives believe in the bent side of human nature. Conservatives believe that human nature is warped. In Christianity, this is called original sin. But there is an understanding in conservatism that there is a tragic dimension to life that cannot be erased. No amount of even material progress necessarily involves moral progress or necessarily involves the removal of basic impediments in human nature. And this is one of the reasons in literature that we study, or we look at, and we enjoy tragedy. So I want to begin a study of Greek tragedy, because Greek tragedy is in some ways the pinnacle of tragedy. It was the philosopher Nietzsche who said that the Greeks understood how to make suffering beautiful, a very evocative phrase, but I think correct. And I want to look at the one of the greatest of the Greek tragedians, Aeschylus. Now, if we think back to the ancient Greeks, they had three prominent award-winning tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. And these guys would enter competitions. At that time in ancient Greece, you would, if you were a playwright, you would enter three plays into competition at the same time. And sometimes the three plays were connected. In Aeschylus, the plays are typically linked. They're part of a trilogy. Sophocles didn't do that. He would put out three plays, but they would be often on different topics, not necessarily linked one to the other. And then there's, of course, the greatest of the Greek comic playwrights. That's Aristophanes. There's really kind of only one. He's in a class by himself. And the difference between Greek comedy and Greek tragedy is this, that tragedy was really developing themes and exploring themes that came out of Greek myth. By Greek myth here, we mean tales about not just the gods, but, and Greece, of course, in ancient times was a polytheistic society. There were many gods. But the interaction between the gods and men. The Greeks believed that there was a time in the past. This is sometimes called by scholars the heroic age, when gods and human beings interacted. Now, if this seems a little insane, a little crazy, let's remember this is also true in the Bible. In the Bible, in very ancient times, God and Adam and Eve interact directly. God doesn't interact quite so directly with Moses or with Abraham, but he does speak to them. He might only show himself in the form of a burning bush, but there is direct communication. And so the Greeks believed that there was a time, a real time on the earth, where gods and humans interacted. And Greek myth is, the stories of Greek myth are located at in this heroic age. So tragedy dealt with that. Comedy dealt with ordinary human beings in their typical lives, typically without the gods intervening in any direct way. People might appeal to the gods or pray to the gods, but the gods aren't on stage. So remarkably, when we say tragedy now, we mean a story that has a horrible ending or leaves you very distressed and troubled. But that's not what the Greeks meant by tragedy. They simply meant by tragedy a play that talks about myth. It was defined by its subject matter, not by the emotions that surround the story itself. Later, tragedy came to take on the specific meaning of a sad or unfortunate tale. And of course, many of the Greek tragedies are in fact about that. Now, we're going to talk about how tragedy began. It began evidently with a guy named Thespis. In English, by the way, the word thespian means an actor on a stage, thespian. For example, I called the Capitol Hill police who came to testify about January 6th. They were kind of, I call them boohoo thespians because they were like, you know, they were acting like they were on a stage. Thespians. Well, Thespis was a Greek who apparently invented tragedy. He's the first guy to put it on the stage. And Aristotle says that before Thespis, you just had a Greek chorus. They would kind of sing. But what Thespis figured out is he removed himself from the chorus. So you had the chorus singing, but then you had one guy, Thespis himself, who would then speak. And this idea of now interacting between a character, Thespis, and the chorus suddenly creates drama. Why? Because you can now have dialogue that goes back and forth. And in fact, by the way, just fast forwarding a little bit, opera, as it developed much later in Italy, was an attempt to imitate the chorus of Greek tragedy. So the opera singers saw themselves as recreating the original Greek stage, so to speak, but singing about tragic stories in choral form. But Greek tragedy was the original effort to on stage dramatize these fundamental human conflicts. Now, the subject of these Greek tragedies, and I'm really not even hardly going to be able to get into the plot of Aeschylus. I'm going to just kind of lay out the background today. the subject of Greek tragedy, the main subject, was the Trojan War. And the Trojan War was the great war that was fought between the Greeks and the Trojans, because the Trojan prince Paris abducted the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen, a Greek princess married to a man named Menelaus, and Paris then spirited away Helen back to Troy. Menelaus went to his brother Agamemnon, the most powerful king of Greece. Now, Greece wasn't a single country. It was many little kingdoms, and it had many kings. And all the kings, all the Greek kings had to come together and collectively decide that they would launch what is now known as the Expedition of 1,000 Ships to Troy, to burn Troy and get Helen back. This was an act not just of recovery, but also of revenge. And a number of the great Greek tragedies are taken from stories of the Trojan War. Now, a part of the Trojan War story is covered in Homer's two great epics. Homer's were not plays. Homer's epics were sung by a bard, by a kind of poet, and they were recited in the oral tradition. Homer wrote the Odyssey, but he also wrote the Iliad. And the Iliad and the Odyssey cover some, but not all, of the story of the Trojan War. What we will see is that in my focus on Aeschylus, and I'm going to focus on Aeschylus's great trilogy, it's called the Orestia. It's divided into three parts. The first part is called Agamemnon, which I'll discuss separately in one segment tomorrow. And then I'm going to discuss his other two plays, which are part of the same trilogy. They're called Libation Bearers and Eumenides. I'll discuss those together, I guess, on Monday. So this will then take me through the an examination of one of the greatest works of Greek tragedy. I'll try to draw the lessons out of it from human experience. Now, just a little word about Aeschylus before I close. Aeschylus wrote 90 plays. Unfortunately, only 7 survive. This is a great loss. It shows you that in the ancient tradition, when things were done orally, we have so little of what was created in the past. So here's one of the greatest playwrights of all time. In fact, the first great playwright of all time. And we only have, well, about 10% of his corpus. Aeschylus fought, by the way, in the Battle of Marathon, a great battle between the Greeks and the Persians. He was most proud of being a soldier, not a poet. In fact, if you look at his epitaph, which, according to tradition, he composed himself, it just says, Aeschylus, who fought at the Battle of Marathon. Makes no reference to the fact that he was a playwright, makes no reference to the Orestia. But this trilogy, which we're going to talk about starting tomorrow, is an examination of the great themes of revenge, of justice, and of man's duties to the gods or to the transcendent. And by looking at these, we get from the earliest times, going back to the 5th century BC, an insight not only into how those people lived and what was important to them, but a deeper understanding of what should be and is important to our own lives.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.